So here we go.
Yeah.
Terrence Ching, welcome to Radio Curious.
Thanks for having me.
What got you involved in this book? Why did you decide to write it?
Well, I remember seeing the Tiananmen Square massacre happen when I was 17 years old, and at that time I had never really had any kind of exposure or understanding of my connection to Chinese history or culture or Chinese tradition. I had just been a normal American kid growing up, but when I saw Tiananmen Square happen, it really shocked me and disturbed me in a way, and it made me make this connection with the Chinese people and my Chinese legacy that I had never had before. So as I got older, I began to look for content that was compelling to me. I had decided I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to write about something that was important, something that was haunting and moving and emotionally compelling. And I kept coming back to Tiananmen Square as I studied Chinese history. And the fact that I did not know who this young man who stood in front of the tank was, the fact that every book that I read that mentioned Tiananmen Square and went into detail about Tiananmen Square had absolutely no corroboration for who this young man was, I was just fascinated and haunted by him. So I decided that in my first fiction that I would try to create a life and a voice for him because he was too important of a kind of global icon to be forgotten or to be a kind of footnote of history. So I wanted to create something that would be honorable and respectful of, you know, the humanity of what he did.
Where did you go to get his character and the character of his brother?
Well, the character of Xiao Di, who is the young man who stood in front of the tanks in my novel, I tried to create a character that was realistic in the setting of the times, Beijing 1989. What kind of students were out there? What were some of the feelings amongst the students who were rebelling at that time? So I just read a lot and I did a great amount of research on other students who were there. So Xiao Di is a kind of amalgam of some real students, or at least what I perceived of those real students. And the fictional brother, Lu, who was ultimately commissioned to find his dissident younger brother, he was a character that I was literally creating on the fly. I had researched a little bit about the Chinese military, but he was someone who I was more interested in his emotions and how his actions are mysterious even to himself because he doesn't understand his own emotions. So I had a great amount of flexibility to create these characters, but they had to be realistic inside the historical setting.
Where do these characters come from in your personal experience?
Well, not very much, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, I think the only similarities between myself and Xiao Di possibly are that, you know, we both went to colleges in upstate New York. But other than that, I have never lived under tyranny. I have never lived in a kind of state of oppression that Xiao Di does in Sons of Heaven. And with Lu, the soldier who has so many tumultuous emotions and feelings, again, these are things that I've never personally experienced, but that gave me a great amount of flexibility again to create and to be free with the feelings and the themes that I was trying to develop, you know. And again, I don't have an older brother either. I'm an only child, so I'm really trying to create things that are fresh and new inside the book while staying realistic.
It seems like you've captured a lot of the images. I've traveled some, but not extensively in China. And when you talk about the communities and the way people live, it is in many ways what I saw. How were you able to capture those images?
Well, I had never been to China before until I went back to research the setting, the environment, to really feel a connection with the physical presence of Beijing. It's such an amazing and enormous place, and I knew that I could not write a book set in Beijing unless I actually went there and spent a little time there. So I went back and I didn't talk to any government officials, obviously. I didn't look for any dissidents because I had already constructed much of the plot and the character in my head, but I hadn't written a word yet. And I needed to go back and really feel that grounding in the setting. And I just walked around and I talked to people I just tried to immerse myself in all the nooks and crannies of the city while I was there. And it made a big impact on me, which is why I felt very comfortable writing that inside of that setting.
How is your facility with the Chinese language?
I speak Mandarin relatively well. I won't say that I'm 100% fluent, but I speak Mandarin at probably about 60-65% fluency.
Learn from your family?
Yes, I grew up speaking Mandarin and English because my, you know, I came to the United States with my parents when I was just 1 year old, and we settled in New York, and I grew up speaking English and Chinese, and you know, as I've gotten older and I'm working and I, you know, I obviously don't live with my parents anymore, my opportunity to speak Chinese is not as great, but I still speak it relatively well.
What's your parents' take on your story on the Sons of Heaven?
My parents at first were a little concerned because they come from a different upbringing and mentality in terms of how they view communism and Chinese nationalism and so on and so forth, because my grandmother on my mother's side was a senator who had worked for the Kuomintang, the Chinese Nationalist Party. So she worked with Chiang Kai-shek, and ultimately my grandparents were forced to flee Beijing in 1949 when Mao Zedong came to power. So my mother grew up with obviously very strong sentiments toward communism and communist the Communist Party. So when she saw that I was writing this book about Deng Xiaoping, one of the main characters as well, and Tiananmen Square, she was a little concerned. But now that she's read the book, and I think she sees that it's more about the humanity of these characters and not the politics of it, I think she feels more comfortable, and my father is happy and proud as well.
You say that their sentiments are a little different than yours.
Mm-hmm.
What are yours?
Well, you know, I'm an American. I've grown up here. I've spent, you know, my entire life here, basically. So I don't have a kind of pre-existing notion of what communists are or are not. You know, I don't trust the media to tell me what communism means. I read, I do research, I try to understand it for myself. And my parents came from an upbringing where they were dictated what communism meant. And then their parents, my grandparents, and their friends and everyone around them as they were growing up and becoming adults had gone through certain experiences that I had never gone through. So I don't have that kind of emotional baggage carried around because I've had the opportunity to grow up here. That being said, you know, it's pretty obvious to me that the communist system, especially in China, is flawed. And if you look at some of the pure statistics, such as the fact that by the year 2005, there are going to be approximately 20 million unemployed people in China. And in that same year or around that same time, their social security system is more likely than not going to be bankrupt. So the Iron Rice Bowl has so many cracks in it, and it's just very obvious that change is needed.
What sort of change do you foresee?
I think that there's a slow path of economic and social and political reform going on right now. And I think, if anything, Tiananmen Square really exacerbated the need for that. A kind of unspoken understanding now exists, in my view, between the people of China and the Chinese government, in that Tiananmen Square can never happen again. The government knows that they can never militarily repress a democracy or social movement the way they did in June of 1989, because that would ultimately jeopardize their WTO membership, and a lot of money is at stake, and the livelihood of an entire nation really depends on the future of China's involvement in the WTO and numerous other pacts that are over my head, because I'm not a social scientist or anything along those lines. That being said, I think the people also understand that there is always the possibility that the Chinese communist government could turn the military on them. And that ultimately leads them to protest in forms that are not as threatening to the old school hardline Chinese leaders. So I think they're working together in a kind of unspoken silent pact to make life better.
I'd like to take a moment and say that this week on Radio Curious, we're talking with Terence Cheng from his office in New York City. Terence is the author of a recent novel, Sons of Heaven, about Tiananmen Square and three people who participated in the activities there in 1989. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Terence, when you went to Beijing to do your research on this novel, did you stand at the point on Tiananmen Square where the character in your novel stood in front of the tanks?
I walked down that exact avenue, and I walked by that exact place. I mean, you know, where that young man stood in front of the tanks was in the middle of Chang'an Avenue, this massive avenue that runs through the heart of Beijing. Obviously, I couldn't stand on that point because there were, you know, dozens and dozens of cars rushing by, but I did walk by that exact point, and then I did, you know, head over to Tiananmen Square and just walk around that entire area and just kind of absorb and really feel the momentousness of that place. Try to soak up that history.
Tell us the feelings.
It's really quite remarkable. And to go to Tiananmen Square, it's almost hard to put into words because Tiananmen Square is absolutely enormous. It is so massive. I mean, if you can imagine standing in what feels like the middle of a major football stadium, and you look around at the kind of enormous proportions of this space. I mean, Tiananmen Square is bigger than that. Tiananmen Square is bigger than a professional football stadium in pure acreage. It's huge. So you just look around and you see all this incredible space, and then you see the buildings and like the Great Hall of the People and the history museums. And then right across from Tiananmen Square is the Gate of Heavenly Peace leading to the Forbidden City, where the emperors used to live in Beijing. So you are just surrounded by history and by this incredible grand architecture, and you can really feel the kind of spirit of what all that means. And it was quite overwhelming.
What did you find to be the sentiment of the Chinese people about what occurred in Tiananmen Square?
Well, no one would talk to me about it. I went there under the guise of a kind of clueless tourist, of course. You know, I didn't go there scoping people out and trying to dig into archives or anything along those lines. I went there to do atmospheric and kind of environmental research. That being said,
Was that the guise of your trip or the actual intent?
Well, I went there because I needed to feel and smell and taste Beijing, but I also had never been back. So, of course, I wanted to go to the Great Wall of China. I wanted to go to the Forbidden City and to see all the beautiful attractions there. But the main purpose was to learn Beijing as a person, being able to walk through the streets so that I could write about it. So it's kind of visceral research in a sense. But when I was there, I spoke to people on the streets, shopkeepers, people selling food on the streets, and hotel workers, cab drivers. I would try to talk to any common person who I could strike up a conversation with, and at some point I would always ask them what they thought of Tiananmen Square, because I was back there in April of 1999, which is approximately 10 years after the original events of Tiananmen Square had begun in June of 89. So it was very close to the 10-year anniversary. And the second I brought up Tiananmen Square, everyone shut down. Anyone I was talking to automatically shut down. And it was like I was speaking a different language. No one would speak to me about it.
Why do you think that was?
Because I think people are afraid.
They didn't know who you are?
They don't know who I am. They just see this Americanized Chinese man walking around, very friendly, but suddenly asking about a topic that is purely taboo. People are afraid to talk about Tiananmen Square because they're afraid of the repercussions. I think Tiananmen Square, to the Chinese people, both in China and overseas, is still an unreconciled situation. It is a scar that has not healed and probably will not heal until someone takes responsibility for what happened, and those people are in the Chinese government. Someone in the Chinese government needs to show some kind of culpability.
For our listeners who may not know what happened, can you briefly summarize what occurred those days?
Yes. In April of 89, a very popular former leader of the Chinese government passed away. And the students in Beijing marched in the streets to memorialize him. Now, that march turned into a movement where the students saw the opportunity to voice their displeasure with the existing government and the existing leaders, and some of their complaints could be heard through this kind of public outcry of grief. All that snowballed to a point because the Chinese government, through their main newspaper, denounced this spur-of-the-moment movement by the students as counter-revolutionary and rightist, and accused the students of trying to create chaos, which is a very sensitive word because its connotation is the Cultural Revolution, when there was an incredible amount of damage done to the people of the country. So the students were very angry, and the protests got bigger. It finally came to a climax when the students went on a hunger strike as Mikhail Gorbachev was visiting China for the first time in 30 years that a Soviet leader was visiting China. So Deng Xiaoping was humiliated, and then they decided that they would try to clear the square by using the military and by declaring martial law, but that didn't work. So then there was a kind of 10-day, 12-day stagnation where no one was sure exactly what would happen. The students were still in the square. The government was wanting to do something but not sure what to do. Then finally, on June 3rd, the military moved in with a kind of clear the square at any costs mandate, and that's exactly what happened when the massacre began.
And the massacre meant what?
The massacre meant that an entire army division was brought in, and they were shooting and killing not only protesting students, but anyone who they saw in the streets. You know, reports are that 1,000 people were killed. Some reports are as high as 3,000. Other reports are in the hundreds. But the fact that a nation's own military was called in to kill its own citizens shows the utter brutality and almost psychotic state that that nation was in. So it is an incredibly disturbing and moving time because you did have certain acts by individuals, such as this man who stood in front of the tank, who showed that the human spirit transcends a kind of brutal animal-like violence.
In your novel, The Sons of Heaven, you portray the man who stood in front of the tanks. Could you please read that section of the book for us?
Sure. This is a section from the novel where Xiao Di, the character I've created based on the man who stood in front of the tanks, actually confronts those tanks. I saw tanks in a line down the avenue, the long guns pointing forward. They were moving fast. I was close to the square and felt something inside me burst. The tanks came closer. I could see at least three, maybe four. I stopped walking, caught in the sound of the treads, the roar and rumble of the engines, their procession a spectacle in itself. I walked into the avenue, and they did not slow down. When I was in the middle of the street, I wondered if they could see me. I heard voices around me. "What are you doing? Get out of the way. They're going to run you over." I felt the vibration of the earth. I started waving my arms. People were shouting. I felt this electric, boiling anger, this frantic rage. I stood there and did nothing, waiting. I wanted them to kill me the way they had killed Wang and how many others, without reason, in cold blood. The tanks had slowed and were creeping forward. I felt cool, though I was sweating. Everything stopped. I stared into the green metal and waited.
And that sets up the image that so many of us remember from those days.
It's a very even to this day, when I watch that footage of the man stepping before the tanks and then climbing on top of the tank and pounding on the hood and fighting with this tank driver or the captain or whoever that soldier was, I mean, it sends chills up my spine because it is such an incredible moment where the bravery and the courage and the rage of that one man came to symbolize so much more.
How are those symbols rooted in the Chinese culture?
The symbol of the young man and the tanks, I think that ultimately he is someone, he and his actions are rooted in the hearts and the spirit of the people who believe in a pure democracy in China and all around the world. At the same time, I also, from my research, understand that the younger generation in China now, who maybe was too young to really understand what was going on in Tiananmen Square 13 years ago, they are not as concerned with a kind of retribution for what happened because they are more focused on moving their lives forward, on making money, on making something of themselves, and they are not as easily swept up in the fervor of a cause. Maybe they're more pragmatic. And I don't think that is, you know, that's my interpretation of it, and I don't think that's emblematic of the entire nation, of course. But I think on a global scale, what that young man did by standing in front of the tanks was really kind of shake us to our sensibilities. You know, he is literally an everyman, an anti-hero of sorts, because we don't know his name, we don't know his history, we don't even know what happened to him, we don't know if he's dead or alive, and yet he demonstrated in those brief moments possibly more bravery than any of us had witnessed to that point by a single individual, which is why I think he is so captivating.
And that certainly comes across in The Sons of Heaven as I read it.
Well, thank you. I was trying to create something that was, again, respectful of the actions of this young man because they are so important, and they are important, and they also ring true to so many people on an almost unspeakable level. It's hard to really kind of elucidate those types of feelings because they speak to us in a way that we are not used to dealing with, not used to confronting those types of emotions.
Well, Terrence, what can we look forward to seeing from your pen?
Well, I have ideas for two more novels. The next novel, which I've already begun researching, is set in China during the Japanese occupation of China around the time of the Rape of Nanking, 1937. And it's another almost catastrophic situation that I think many of us in the West don't fully understand, the war crimes that the Japanese committed. I am intrigued by them. I'm horrified by them, and I'm fascinated by them because many of these were common and good people who went to war and became monsters. They did monstrous things, but it's too easy to categorize them as monsters for what they did. They are human beings as well, and I want to examine some of the humanity of that. I would also like to delve into some of the characters who survived that period when these atrocities were happening, but the human spirit that guided them to survival, to fight, and to really sustain their lives and their families, that I think is a theme that compels me emotionally and I think is worth writing about. So that's my next one. We'll see if I can pull it off.
Well, I hope so.
I hope so too.
Well, Terrence Chen, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book.
Well, the last book that I read that I thought was really quite amazing was a novel called Ghostwritten by David Mitchell. And it is a first novel, and it is a big, ambitious, literary book that is challenging but also very entertaining. And, I mean, literary pyrotechnics at its best. It's really a fantastic book, and it's worth a very close look at. So it's a Ghostwritten by David Mitchell.
I wanted to ask you something about when you went to Beijing.
Sure.
Did you travel by yourself?
Yes.
What was that like?
It was a lot of fun, actually, because I could focus and I could stay in the mindset that I needed to be in to really absorb the city the way I needed to write about it properly. If I had gone with a girlfriend or with my parents or with a tour group, there would have been no freedom for me to move around. When I wanted to see sites that were outside of the city, I rented a driver and a car for a day, or I just had the complete freedom to wander Beijing at will and to get lost in the Hutongs and to take 4 hours to meander through the Forbidden City and to just really kind of soak up as much as I could. It was actually quite invigorating. I never felt lonely for a moment. I never felt bored for a moment. I was pretty excited the whole time because I knew that this was going to give me what I needed to write the book I wanted to write.
Well, Terence Cheng, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thanks for having me.
That's great. Good interview.
Thank you.
Yeah, I like that.
Good questions.
You know, thank you. I never know where they're going until we just sort of start.
But that's why, like I said, I like doing things spontaneously because, you know, sometimes you just come up with stuff you never thought about before, and it always comes out best in that first shot, right?
Yeah, I know.
You try to repeat it, and it comes out like crap.
I know. That's why I didn't want you to start answering the questions earlier.
Right.
I'm going to take that section about traveling in Beijing.
Uh-huh.
Put it back in. I'm just going to move it.
Sure.
Put it back to where we were.
Sure.
What do you do for Random House?
I am a director of corporate website marketing. So
really?
I do kind of web development, new technologies and applications, e-books, digital distribution, strategic alliance. I do like 5 different jobs. I mean, it's all over the place.
So you have 2 lives.
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah. I understand that. So do I.
Yeah, you have to, you know. I mean, they don't write health insurance into your book contract, so you gotta have something.
I know, one to make the money and one to have the interesting opportunities.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So you know, we'll see how long I can carry this on.
Well, good luck to you, and I'll look forward to your next book.
Thanks. Now, do you know when this might air or might not air? Or?
I'm looking
I know it takes a while to edit and all
that
stuff. Yeah,
I like to edit them right after I record them.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier. This is going to air in, I think the next open date is July 16th.
That's great.
So it's 16 or 23.
And are you syndicated? I'm sorry, I don't know more about your show, but are you syndicated or how does that work?
Somewhat syndicated on public radio.
Okay.
I'm actually looking for a syndicator,
right?
You know, who can get it out more far and wide. It's on several stations in Northern California.
Right.
And in Albany, New York.
Great.
The University at Albany.
Awesome.
Carries my stuff. And you can find some of it if you go to talkinghistory.org, looking under recent programs under Radio Curious.
That's great. Or
my name.
Yeah, I did a quick search of your name and the program online, so I know that I can find it whenever. Mm-hmm. I was just kind of wondering. But thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
You know, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And
I'm glad you liked the book, too.
I did. It was very compelling. I get hundreds of books.
I'm sure. And, I'm sure.
You know, 80% of them go to the library.
Right.
Some of them just, you know, go separate. But this one caught my eye. I traveled in China in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand it's very different.
Yeah, I mean, I was there in 99. I haven't gone back, and, you know, I would like to go back. I just don't know what the reception is going to be like. But talking to people on my tour recently who have been back, I mean, they say that, you know, well, hey, I went there in the early 80s when Deng was first coming to power. I went there in the early 90s right after Tiananmen, and then they've gone back recently, and they do say it's drastically different.
Hmm.
So I'm very curious to go back.
Yeah.
I just don't want to, you know, get thrown in a gulag or anything.
I know.
So, so we'll see how that shakes out.
You have the identification.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a problem.
Exactly. So we'll see. But I have to run off to a meeting. But thank you very much, Barry, for having me on the show.
Likewise. Thanks
for your time.
I appreciate
it. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.